Welcome to the Orbital Sunrise podcast, sharing ideas that are catalysts for action to drive an inclusive and equitable world. Your hosts are
Elizabeth Harrison, ocean engineer, presenter and engineering communicator and futurist.
And Ruth Harrison, aerospace engineer, space industry communicator and diversity advocate.
This Orbital Sunrise podcast will educate and empower people by sharing the impacts of STEM, science, technology, engineering and maths. Our Series 1 key themes are unpacking the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal 8, economic growth, humanising STEM, thought leadership and engineering futurist.
We would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we are broadcasting today, acknowledge their continuing connection to the land, air and sea and pay our respects to their elders past and present. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today. If you would like to support our podcast, please share with your friends, leave a review, or check out our Patreon site. Welcome to episode 5 of the Orbital Sunrise podcast. Today, we welcome Catherine Ziesink, defence thinker, writer, communicator, and pot stirrer. With an economics and journalism degree and a master's in strategic policy from the Australian Defence Force Academy, extensive time managing and editing online and print editorials and magazine. Catherine spent 15 years with Australian Defence Magazine before leaving last year for new adventures and is now the Strategic Communications Manager for Hanwha Defence Australia. Welcome, Catherine.
Hi, Elizabeth. Hi, Ruth. How are you going?
Good, thank you. And how are you today?
I'm well. I think like everyone, I'm getting over a cold, which I'm very happy was not flu and not COVID. And we'd all forgotten just how rubbish an ordinary cold could be.
Yeah, it can be pretty rubbish, but glad you're definitely on the mend.
Yeah, glad to hear that you're getting better. So today we'd just like to start. Can you tell us what your pronouns are, please, Catherine?
She, her.
Fantastic. And would you be able to give us your personal elevator pitch?
Oh, goodness me. So my personal elevator pitch, I am a communicator. So I think most things in the world come down to good communication, whether it be written, verbal, spoken, unspoken. And my job is to help build bridges between people, between organizations. And I love doing that. I love helping other people understand what the art of the possible is. Yeah.
Yeah, communication is such a key aspect in all things. Yeah, everything related, and particularly STEM as well, which is not necessarily the best in that. But, yeah, great to have a communicator on board. So here at Orbital Sunrise, companies are shaped by people. And so we're interested in exploring your kind of defence portfolio, where your beginnings have, et cetera. So would you be able to tell you a little bit about your defence experience and background and how you got involved in this sector and, you know, the adjacent sectors as well?
Sure. So in the long, long ago, I left straight from school and I went and did a double degree in economics and journalism at the University of Canberra. And I was so sure that I wanted to be a business writer. So I wanted to write about financial markets and superannuation, and with a focus on young people, so why you should care about finance and how it affects your life day to day. And I did that freelance for a little while, and then I realized it really wasn't for me. And I think it came down to the people. So I love the content, but the people I found were very beige, for lack of a better word. It was all about the numbers. It was less about the story and the narrative behind what was happening, and was just about the numbers. And that really, look, I struggled with it, I'll be honest. So I made the logical jump and I went into healthcare administration for a little while because I had moved up to Brisbane for my then husband's job. And when we were both studying, we made the deal that whoever got the coolest job first, we would move for that job. And I made that decision purely knowing that I was going to get the coolest job first. and then I didn't. He did. So we're up in Brisbane. And so the network that I'd been cultivating in Sydney and Melbourne wasn't really a lot of use. So yeah, I'm in Brisbane. I really struggled to find a job because I had one unit left at university and I had so many interviews where I was told that I was overqualified or underqualified or I was a flight risk. because I would get the job and I'd be there for 6 months and then find something bigger and better and new. So, as I said, went into healthcare for a little while, and then I came across the workplace situation where in my, I think, early 20s, I didn't have the skills to resolve. And I was bullied, essentially, and I did not have the skills at the time to resolve that. So the only step I thought I could take was to leave. And that's when I fell back onto my regular skills that I learned at university. So I went on to Seek, and I applied for every single journalism and economics job I could possibly find in Brisbane. And one of them was an ad on Seek for then Yaffa Publishing, and they wanted a staff writer on defense, national security, and commercial aviation. Things I had a very vague interest in. So I met maybe 60% of the job criteria, and I applied anyway. And I had an interview with the publisher and founder of Australian Defence Magazine, ADM, an amazing woman called Judy Hins. And it was less of an interview and more of a 45-minute chat about life, love, and the universe.
Right.
And I started 2 weeks later. So a staff writer in journalism world is essentially the office pleb. If anything needs doing, oh, Kath can do that. And I did. My content knowledge grew in a vertical fashion. So I just spent a lot of time reading back issues of the three magazines that I was working on and learning everything I could about those three industries. Defense was more fun. I put in more effort. I had an amazing team around me where there were no stupid questions. And believe me, oh my goodness, did I test that? I asked some really stupid questions. But they were always answered. They were always answered in the spirit in which I put them out into the world in terms of, you know, help me learn. So I was in sponge mode. And I think that's pretty much how I live my life, in sponge mode. You know, every day where I don't learn something new is a day wasted, as far as I'm concerned. So I worked my way up the tree, staff writer to editor of ADM. And then I became managing editor down the line, which means I had profit and loss responsibility for that group within Yaffa Media. Built a team. I managed a print magazine, weekly newsletters, daily newsletters, social media, events, awards, an amazing team of editorial writers. I had shared services in the background for production staff and design and finance and all those other good things. And it was a job that took me around the world. It supported me through doing a master's at UNSW out at ADFA, through two kids, from moving from Brisbane down to Canberra, because in the defence world, if you don't have someone in Canberra, then you're clearly not trying. And it was an absolute adventure, and I adored my time there. It was my privilege to ask stupid questions of everyone and everything. So I got to ask, what does that do? How does that work? Why do we do it like this? Explain it to me like I'm 10. And I think I stuck around in defence so long because people are passionate and they care. There is a sense of service, which I really enjoy and I really like. And there was always a new technology and a new project and a new program to learn about. So I was always challenged, and I enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. Is that the defense is fun bit? I think you've just summed it up just nicely with that aspect as well, which is fantastic. You mentioned that, you know, you're leading, you went into managing editing for the Australian Defence Magazine for quite a number of years. And now you're in a new role, which you're not leading that team. You're just in that team. What sort of findings or adjustments or other things, like, is this good or bad or different now with that leadership journey?
I would not say good or bad. I would definitely say different. So, you know, for a long time at ADM, I was very much in the leadership role. And I got that at a very young age, which was interesting. So I had two main mentors within my organization. So on the editorial front, I had Greg Ferguson, who's the former editor of ADM, and the publisher and founder, Judy Hins. So I got a really good balance of the business of publishing and then the content of defence. So that was a really nice balance. And Judy taught me a lot about managing people. And for the entire time that I was with ADM, I pretty much worked remotely, I think, for the first, for the first 18 months. So worked from home, all of my team worked from home or remotely. And so COVID wasn't a huge change for us. And then when I left ADM, the new job that I started straight from the magazine, I started during lockdown. Mm-hmm. And that was hard. That was really hard. So I had been institutionalized, I'll be honest. Mm-hmm. You know, we tend to think of that particularly in defense, you know, for uniformed people. But because I had been with one company for so long, admittedly in different roles, but it was still one company. It was still one culture, one way of doing things. And I think I struggled a lot when I moved out into that first new job because I had to learn a new culture and new people and new processes at home while the world was in lockdown. And it's really hard, I think, to build relationships remotely. Very much a face-to-face kind of person when I'm getting to know people. I think you can maintain a relationship remotely. So, you know, on Zoom, on WebEx, on all those wonderful video conferencing programs that we all have gotten used to using over the last 2 years. But I think it's really hard for new starters. Really hard. So, yes, I do enjoy being part of a team rather than leading a team now, but it has required some gear changes in my mind. And it made me reflect and think on my own leadership style when I was at ADM. I'm like, how many accommodations did my team make for me based on my leadership style? You know, I'm a person that likes to have a phone call and then I follow up with an email. I had team members who were very much, you know, don't email me, I don't care. I had one team. Well, it's not that they don't care. It's just that they don't live on their email, shall we say. So if I wanted something done urgently, it was always going to be a phone call or a text. And it was interesting, as I said, trying to get your head around a new organizational structure when you couldn't see it in action. So I really feel for particularly younger people in the workforce who are, you know, perhaps coming out of uni and have gone into the workforce in the last year or two and don't know what workplace norms look like. Like, that is very, very hard. And so if you're someone that is not particularly extroverted or is good at reaching out, is good at cold calling people within your own organization, then it's hard. It's really hard, I would say. So I do feel for people starting their careers or transitioning in their careers right now, regardless of what area it's in.
Can you elaborate a little bit more onto what was it that prompted you to leave ADM and go out into the world when you did?
Oh, that's a tough one. So after 15 years at ADM, I would say I was quite comfortable in that job. Yes, it was a big job. Yes, it was busy and I loved it. But it was also, to be honest, ladies, I hit a period of burnout. You know, things had piled on personally and professionally and I just hit the wall. And I needed to do something new. I needed to challenge myself. I needed to, I guess, reset a little bit. And, you know, I think we all have those times in our life where, you know, you run out of social capital. You know, you've spent it all and you're not doing anything to recharge that. So I needed to recharge. So I took 6 weeks off and I don't think I've had 6 weeks off since I was at school. You know, and God, that's 20 years ago now. And yeah, that was a very good thing. And whilst I was on that leave period, I realized that I needed to change my job, and that, you know, that came with its own grieving process, I would say.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm glad I made the change, but it was a big change. and it was scary and wonderful and terrifying and, you know, all of those emotions within seconds of one another.
How did you find the sort of the public reaction to that? Because you're obviously pretty well known within the, I would say very well known within the defence industry, and you have a lot of connections there. Was there as much shock or surprise, or was it just love that came forward for you? What did you feel?
Look, there was a lot of love, and that was lovely, I'll be honest. So I find media is a very one-way kind of format, I would say. So I would put things out into the world and you never know where those ripples end up. So I would chair a lot of conferences. I would do a lot of public speaking as well in my role, which I quite liked. But I always found it a little bit stressful and terrifying as well. So I call it my shiny professional face. So I'd put on my shiny professional face and I would go out and I would do the things. And then the next day or two after that, I would essentially crawl into a hole and I would do all of my work on email. I would take minimal phone calls, minimal meetings, because I'd used up all of that social capital. And it was taking me, I think, longer to recharge from that as well. I still get messages from a lot of people who are just like, oh, I missed your commentary. I'm like, really? I mean, that's awesome. But usually in media land, like the only time you get any kind of feedback is when you get something wrong. Mm-hmm. So people will call up and say, oh, I think you'll find the flight envelope of that particular platform is this. I'm like, oh, okay. Thank you for the update. I will put that piece of knowledge in my knowledge bank and apply it accordingly in the future. But yeah, it's been quite strange. There's been one or two times, I think, since I left the magazine where I have regretted leaving. So, you know, when the AUKUS announcement came last year. So, you know, the Australian government stepped away from the partnership with the French to build the attack class submarines and turned everything on its head to work with the US and the UK on a range of strategic technologies and approaches there. And my phone started going nuts at about 10 p.m. the night before because, you know, there was an announcement coming. Government was doing things.
What do you know?
And, oh, who's saying what? When are they saying it? Oh, what are they saying? And at about 1 a.m. I realized, wait a minute, this isn't my job anymore. And I turned off my phone and I just went to sleep because I could. And that was a bit of a revelation. But having said that, you know, when all of that was announced, I'm just like, you know, I had a lot of opinions, obviously, but I no longer had a platform to share those opinions. And also, who cares about my opinion now? Like, what value do I bring to the conversation now that I am no longer the editor of one of the nation's leading trade publications?
I think that's a little bit harsh on yourself there, Catherine, in that you have an awful lot of knowledge across it. And I think for me personally, something that I realized recently is that, you know, we really do relate knowledge to specialism. You know, if you're a specialist in an area, then you've got a lot of knowledge. But for me personally, the broadness of my knowledge is what makes me special. And I think the same would be the same for you, Catherine, is that you have this broad range of knowledge across an industry that not many people get to see, that across the range thing. And whilst, you know, obviously you're not in that role now, that doesn't change that you have worked in, you know, a very diverse way within the defence industry that a lot of people wouldn't understand. You know,
as I said, it was a privilege. And defence is very cumulative. So the way the magazine worked, you know, you got to deep dive into something for 4 to 6 weeks every year on the same topic. So I started writing about submarines in 2006 and I was still writing about submarines when I left. And I'm pretty sure if I ever go back into media, guess what? I'll still be writing about submarines in some way, shape or form. And for a non-engineer, I would like to think I have a pretty decent understanding of air-independent propulsion systems. because that's something that I had to learn about. As I said, you know, my privilege was talking to subject matter experts and going, explain it to me.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that I had various people within my network. So I would write something and then go, oh, this needs a sanity check. You know, I know paragraphs A, B, and C are all facts-based, but D is my conclusion. D is how I have joined the dots together. Like, this is my opinion based on these facts. Have I reached a logical conclusion? Because I'm not an engineer. I've never served. I've never worn a uniform. I've never worked in the Australian Public Service. I'm not APS. And the conversation that I am having is happening at a public, unclassified level. So there will always be parts of the conversation that I am missing out on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's appropriate. But yeah, there were many, many things where, you know, sometimes I got my conclusion wrong. So, you know, listeners, right now, think of a four-legged animal with a tail that you can pat that you would like to have at your house. My 11-year-old son said a panther. My 8-year-old son said a giraffe. And I was thinking like a cat or a dog. So we were each given the same data points and we drew very different pictures. And for me, that is what communication is about. You know, we all have access to the same data points, but whether or not we're aware of them, or we know where they are, or we know who they came from, or what the agenda is behind those, I think remains to be seen. And that's why communication, when done right, is so powerful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we often don't notice it being done well, but, oh, geez, we notice it when it's done badly, don't we?
Indeed. Connection of dots.
I'm interested to know how you've transferred from being a very public voice and opinion on industry to now working inside that industry and not being able to have perhaps such a public voice or a public opinion, shall we say, on what's happening. How are you finding that transition?
Look, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. Working behind the scenes has given me a much greater appreciation of all the moving parts that happen in our industry. So there have been a couple of people that I have called in the last 12 months and apologized for my very bullshit behavior on a couple of things. because being part of the media, I'm just like, why is it so hard? Now I know the answer to that question. It is so hard because there are so many moving parts. I think what I miss most is probably the independence and the perception of independence. So anything now that I put out into the world is seen through the lens of, oh, she works for Hanwha.
Yep.
So, you know, that bias, perceived or otherwise, is very, very real. So I still do little bits and pieces on the side. So I am going to be chairing the HunterNet Defence Conference up near Newcastle later this year. So that's a gig that I've been doing for a couple of years, and the organisers have very thoughtfully invited me back because, you know, they like what I bring to the table, regardless of what hat I'm wearing. So I'll be emceeing the Defence Teaming Centre gala dinner later this year as well, which I'm very much looking forward to. So catching up with the Adelaide crowd. But there are programs now where it's not appropriate for me to be behind the scenes anymore. Mm-hmm. So ADM runs a Women in Defence Awards program, which I helped set up and run since its inception. And this year I put in some of my colleagues at Hanwha into that program. So I, you know, they received nominations, and I loved working with these women and hearing their stories and developing their nominations. And the finalists were released earlier this month, and none of the three ladies that I put forward were finalists.
Oh.
I know. The thing is, right, this program, I know the caliber of women that get to be finalists.
Yeah.
Because I was a judge on the program. You know, I helped set up the judging criteria. And while I am disappointed that my current colleagues didn't make it as finalists, I know that A, they're amazing women regardless of whether or not they're being recognized in this particular program. And the second thing is that process that ADM goes through, I know is rigorous. I know it's rigorous because I set it up. So if we didn't make the cut, it means the people that did make the cut are hugely inspiring women. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that you're not hugely inspiring just because you're not a finalist. But it means that, you know, the shades between amazing, awesome, cool, inspiring are so slim sometimes that, you know, it's hard to pick. It's so hard to pick. But I love that program. And I think in some way, shape or form, I'm probably always going to be involved no matter what organization I'm working for, because it's a damn good program. And I respect what they're putting out into the world, celebrating amazing women in the defense community.
I think that's a really good segue into into the women in defense. How are we doing? How do you think that we're doing as far as getting more diversity in defense? And what could we be doing better?
So for me, diversity always harkens back to cognitive diversity, which is a concept that I learned about from a former Boeing CEO who has sadly passed away now. And cognitive diversity is about getting different brains at the table and different viewpoints. And that diversity can come from a range of factors. So gender, age, ethnicity, where you are on the spectrum in terms of mental health and sexuality and gender. If you have the same people in the same room at the same time, you will always get the same answer. And so I think we are getting better in some ways. And in others, less so. So gender in the uniformed and the APS side of the defence community, I would say, is getting better, much better. So most of the uniformed services are aiming for between 20 and 25% gender equality, and all three services have programs working towards that. The APS is quite good as well. Once again, they have programs to actively encourage that. Defence industry's pipeline, I think, probably still needs more work, but it's also the pyramid approach as well. So, you know, at the bottom, when you're looking at high school and college and university students, there are less women entering that space.
Yeah.
And it's a leaky pipeline as well. So people come and go. And I think also once you get to a certain level within your career, you stop using a lot of those STEM skills that you studied for and you go into managerial roles where you're not on the tools as much. Yeah. And I think that that's not a gender issue. That's a workforce issue as a whole. Diversity in defence is getting better, but it's still got a long way to go, I would say. And there's a couple of factors in play with that. One of them is security clearances. So in terms of getting international ethnicities through, that's hard because they need to be able to hold an Australian security clearance. The other one I would say is just lack of knowledge that defence is not just about running around in a uniform. It is a big community with lots of diverse skills and options on the table. I think we need to start getting more into school counsellors, like job counsellors, as to what the options are. Mm-hmm. And it's a knowledge gap of what success and good can look like in defence. So there's a lot of work to be done, I would say.
Yeah, agreed. And one of the biggest things at the moment is finding resources within, you know, anywhere, not just in defence, but any, you know, there's a shortage of skilled people. How do we get that knowledge out there? How do we get those opportunities out into the world? What can we be doing better to communicate the roles and what defence actually does?
Look, that is a tough one. I think defence is really good at preaching to the choir. So people that are already aware of defence through family and friend connections, it's the finding new blood essentially. And I think every single industry is facing that problem.
Yeah.
So, you know, COVID over the last 2-3 years has decreased skilled migration hugely. So that traffic of people and that churn of knowledge and technology and IP transfer has been harder because it does come down to people. So I would like to see, I guess, more emphasis put on you can't be what you can't see. I really like that approach. I think we need to be highlighting what we do and how we do it and the why behind what we do as well. Because I think once upon a time, defense was more front of mind for a lot of Australians. Like, you had more interaction with the defense forces. Like, everyone knew someone who was in uniform. Mm-hmm. Whereas I don't think that's the case anymore. You know, unless you live in a defense-centric town, when was the last time you saw a soldier, sailor, or aviator just hanging around the place?
That you can't be what you can't see is a powerful, very powerful theme, strategy, definitely.
Yeah.
On that. So definitely, even like obviously there's engineering within defense, but engineering in general also has that problem. So having a look at sustainability, and Ruth might like to add to this as well, sustainability and defense. Where does defence play in that role, and what are some of defence's biggest challenges from, like, your world or from living, like, you know, what you, yeah, perspective, your perspective on how we, yeah.
I think sustainability in defence has been patchy because there was, I would say, a government in place for quite some time that did not want to hear that used as a metric or an approach or a lens to look at things through.
Mm-hmm.
That is changing, I would say. So when you look, for example, defence is the largest Commonwealth landowner in Australia. So if defence decided that they wanted to have all of their sites run off sustainable energy, that would be a huge signal to the market to say we are serious about what we do and how we do it. You know, if every single new defense facility or upgraded facility had PVs on the roof or had to be at least a 7-star building, I think it's really hard in terms of sustainability to get those quick, easy wins, but then build upon that. So I know there's a bunch of technologies that Defence is looking at around sustainability and what that means going forward. Defence has this strange way of being risk averse and conservative, but also going out on a limb when it comes to thinking of themselves as a learning and training organisation that introduces positive change. So I am looking forward, I think, to the next round of policy paperwork that perhaps brings in climate change and sustainability as one of the key driving principles behind what they do and how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
But they do that at the behest of government. So, you know, there needs to be a value for money case because that is the legislative framework that defence works around. But there also needs to be, I think, more of an understanding of the gains that sustainability can bring that have nothing to do with the bottom line.
Yeah. What do you think of, like, the, apart from government sort of, you know, policy, do you think, feel that there's a willingness within defence to consider this? Is there a, is industry looking at this, or is the defence
architecture itself interested in actually being more sustainable? Because if you think from an outsider's perspective, is defence naturally a sustainable industry as it is? I mean, when you look at it, it's kind of a lot of one-use articles that, you know, go and go into various scenarios. But so is there an interest in developing that as part of the industry, do you think?
Look, I think there's definitely an interest, but I wouldn't characterise it as core business, if that makes sense. So I think there's a lot more automation and big data, which is playing into the decision-making process that defence is looking at. Mm-hmm. And they're taking out, I would say, like the technology evolution that defence is going through, I would say is more sustainable just because of the nature and what they're upgrading and what they're doing. But yeah, as I said, I think it's an issue and it's definitely front of mind, but it is not the driving force.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. Interesting how that develops when it's not core business or driving force. On a slightly sustainability model, so obviously defence and war there's a fit in there. So where does war fit into this sustainability model, like, you know, for future?
Well, war is not sustainable, let's be honest. It's what we seek to avoid at all costs. And yet when we do it, we want to do it quickly and efficiently. You know, the situation in the Ukraine at the moment is horrific. And I think we can all agree that the loss of life that is happening over there at the moment is it's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, Australia for so very long, I think, has been protected by its geography.
Yeah.
You know, we're a long way from anyone. So anyone that wants to reach out, touch us, you know, with weapons, has to be quite close. There's a generation of weapons coming into service now where that will be easier. And there's also this concept in our sector of grey zone operations. So things that are not direct or kinetic, but they happened in cyberspace, they happen with soft power, they happen with shaping. And I think a lot of those things are already happening. When it comes to war and how we fight, I think we need to look at mobilization, like national mobilization. COVID's been a really good example of what we can do when we get together and talk about the art of the possible early. So, you know, there were defense companies that started making face shields that are really good at doing logistics, at rolling things out, about tracking things. You know, the manufacturing side of the house got together very early on, and a design came together in a matter of weeks or months to put together ICU beds manufactured here in Australia, designed and manufactured here, to put together ventilator parts. I think there was an appreciation that our internationally integrated supply chains are vulnerable to a lot of things. The assumptions that we took for granted in what we do and how we do it had to be questioned. You know, that national resilience was shaken. And there were big existential talks about, you know, do we live in a society or do we live in an economy, and how do we balance those things? And I don't think anyone has all the answers. No one government or organization, let alone person, has all the answers in this space. And I think we all want that magic silver bullet, and it just doesn't exist. So we've got to keep those lines of communication open about what we do, about how we do it, and being really clear on what our assumptions are going into any of those talks.
Like, defence has always been sort of criticised for being very siloed, and, you know, left arm doesn't know what the right arm's doing all the time. Do you think that's improved, and do you think that still needs to get better?
Defence doesn't have silos. They have cylinders of excellence, I think you'll find, Ruth.
Great way of...
Oh, I say that tongue-in-cheek. I do.
Coming from a marketing specialist.
No, look, someone introduced me to that term a few years ago, and I did laugh maniacally. But you think about it, though. I mean, so the defence organisation is roughly 100,000 people, give or take, right? When you get to an organisation of that size, you assume that there is a left hand and a left foot and a right foot, and there's a head, and hopefully there's a brain in there somewhere doing things. But you are at a size and scale that, yes, things will get missed. It's that simple. You know, you need to rely on narratives and talking points and stories to get things happening, because you don't have the ability, I think, as a leader to reach out and touch every single person that you need to in order to collaborate and reach a knowledge position that encompasses every single stakeholder that you need to deal with. Mm-hmm. It's just impossible at that scale. And then when you go further than that, so defence, you know, doesn't do things on its own. It does things with whole of government. So it does things with state governments, with federal governments, down to the local council level. And then we start looking internationally, you know, working with other militaries, working with other governments, working with other bodies such as the UN. So, you know, you add layer upon layer of complexity into things. You know, we have systems, and then we have systems of systems, and they all have to play with one another. And it gets hard. And I think a lot of the time we have the technology to do a lot of the things that we want to do, but perhaps we don't have the right processes to get to the outcome that we're aiming for.
Yeah. When you talk about the right processes for where the outcome is, what's your take on innovation, or what's your definition of innovation?
I think innovation is such an intangible. So I think it means different things to different people. And that was definitely my experience working with ADM. So every time innovation would come up as a buzzword, there were a range of reactions. So eyes rolling, eyes glazing over, good Lord, don't make me talk about this again. And innovation to me, in my mind, comes down to doing things differently. And that can be through technology, that can be through process, that can be through people, that can be through a combination of those things. But I don't think innovation is iterative. I think it is meant to be revolutionary. And revolutions are not tidy things that fit neatly in a box. So when you revolutionize, when you innovate, you are leaving things behind. And I think people find it very hard to let go of things and leave them behind, because they're comfy, because they know how to do it, because there's a routine there that they are comfortable with.
Getting into that comfortable.
Yeah. So, you know, this is a really great idea, but there's going to be some short-term pain. So I think that's what's happening in our energy market at the moment. You know, there's short-term pain around moving from fossil fuels into renewable energy. And there are going to have to be some hard and robust conversations that we have as a nation, as an international community, about what good looks like. You know, and there are going to be winners and losers. But the thing is, just because you're a loser for this moment, for these few months, for this year or two maybe, the human capacity to be resilient and move on to the next cool thing is not to be underestimated. You know, there is value in keeping good things, and there is value in finding new things as well. And that balance point, I think, is different for everyone, for individuals, for companies, for organizations, for governments. And we have to try and find a path forward that creates the most amount of win for the most amount of people.
I've got one just question, stepping into your future, and what sort of things you're doing, or Hanwha is doing at Defence Australia.
Yeah, so Hanwha, I joined at a really exciting time. So Hanwha as a company only came into being towards the end of 2019. At the end of 2021, 2 years later, they signed a roughly $1 billion sole source contract for self-propelled howitzers and armoured ammunition resupply vehicles, the Huntsman family vehicles under Program 8116 for those that live and breathe such things. So this company has gone from, you know, a handful of people to just over 90 people in 3 years. Those 3 years have also been COVID affected. This is the first time that Defence has bought a platform off an Asian original equipment manufacturer, an OEM. So they, Defence has taken a risk. They've gone out on a limb and they're doing something different. Because the technology was what they wanted and what they needed, and the industrial, I guess, profile that Hanwha Defence is building up is what government and the Commonwealth are after. So has it been smooth sailing the entire way? God, no. No, they're a startup with a veneer of prime. But they're doing wonderful things. They're doing wonderful things. Elizabeth, Ruth, like I am very excited about my role and what we get to do and how we get to do it. The team of people that I'm working with are amazing. I am definitely fulfilling my learning something new every day.
Fantastic.
Viewpoint. And, you know, obviously vehicle programs are a big part of what they do, but we're also moving into space, into LEO, into SATCOMs. There's ammunition, there's hydrogen. There are so many cool things. So, I mean, Hanwha as a group, so the Hanwha conglomerate over in South Korea is the seventh biggest company in that nation. They have interests in chemicals, in hydrogen, in PV, renewable energy, in tourism, in hotels, in property. This is a 44,000 strong person company that is global. We're talking multi-billion dollar company. So I think we're sitting at about 70 US billion dollars a year. The defense business, so Hanwha Defense Corporation in Korea, is about 9% of that. And then the Australian business sits under that. And I'm going over to Korea myself next month, and I'm looking forward to meeting some of my colleagues in Korea and getting a handle on the scale and scope of the business as well. So it's, look, I'm super excited, and that's what I need. Like, I need a challenge. I need to feel engaged and interested, like I'm doing something worthwhile. And I have that feeling at Hanwha.
So leading on from that, learning a new thing every day, what have you read recently that's really impacted you, or perhaps listened to a podcast or watched on TV? What's really sort of changed your you've reflected upon and changed your outlook, or really had an emotional response to?
So funnily enough, that gear changed from being the leader to being part of a team was a big one. And I had a friend recommend a book, Legacy. And funnily enough, it's about how the New Zealand All Blacks came together and changed what they do and how they do it to be a team. So it was not about the individual, it was about the team. Mm-hmm. And I found that book especially amazing. That, you know how sometimes you think about something and you're like, yeah, it's kind of coming together, but you haven't had that epiphany moment, like that light switch moment where that switch is flicked and you're like, yes, this makes sense. And I had that while reading that book.
Okay.
And the only reason I read it is because a friend recommended it to me. And as soon as he said All Blacks, I'm not a sports ball person, I'll be honest. And I'm like, okay. And he's like, no, read it. I'm like, okay, all right. And I did. And yeah, it was actually amazing. So the book swap in that case was that I read Legacy from him and I gave him a copy of Invisible Women, which I'm guessing a lot of your listeners have come across. And if they haven't, please, please, please look it up. So whilst I may have an economics degree, maths and I are not good friends. I would say we're acquaintances. But the data gap when it comes to sex aggregated or disaggregated studies is horrific. Mm-hmm. So we need to be able to design things based on data. So, yeah, like this book was so enlightening and so rage-inducing in equal parts. And I love it. And I think I've bought like 27 copies and I just hand them out to people. Read this. Read this and get rage too. Yeah, I love it.
Everyone should read that book. Everybody.
Yeah, everyone can read that book.
Everybody can read it.
I recommend that. It is definitely rage-inducing. I get angry looking. I'm like, oh, I just need to recommend it to people to read it.
Yeah, look, I'm on the mailing list for Caroline as well. So she puts out a weekly newsletter and she's recently started a podcast as well. And I love that community. Basic things when it comes to design that we take for granted. You know, like the way restrooms are put together in public buildings, the way phones are designed for a larger hand. You know, a heart attack in females is different to that of males. The way medications interact with female biology is slightly different to males. Crash test dummies in cars. Like, you know, my organs are shaped slightly differently and in a slightly different order because my pelvis is different. You know, just, please go out and read the book.
I've actually just, it's coming out tomorrow. I've actually just written an article about how a lady in Australia is researching impacts of estrogen and progesterone on space, on astronauts, and how little research there is into how space impacts female astronauts. And it's just like, where are we? We're in 2022 or what? So, you know, why are we still talking about, you know, this? But the research just isn't there yet. So, yeah, it's definitely, definitely rage inducing. I think you've probably answered our last question with perhaps Invisible Women is the answer to 42, but we're going to ask you anyway. So if 42 is the answer to the ultimate question of life and the universe and everything, what do we need to achieve it?
So I turned 40 this year. I had a milestone birthday. And in 2 years' time when I turn 42, in the back of my mind, I have the assumption that I will know all things. That is what I like to think. That at the age of 42, when people reach the age of 42, you have an epiphany where you realize your place in the universe and how you fit into it. And I think we all have glimpses of that. You know, if we find it through our family, through our friends, through our hobbies, through our job, through all of those journeys that we go on. I think 42 has so many different layers and levels of meaning, and I want to experience as many of them as possible. So that's what I'm doing. I'm going out and experiencing the world as much as I can.
Well, happy 40th, and wishing so many more experiences and adventures and endeavors to come, Catherine.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. We hope you had fun.
No, it's been wonderful. Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you, Ruth. I must admit, when you reached out to me, I'm probably not your normal STEM type person. I am STEAM. I put the arts into STEM because I think there is, there needs to be a balance there as well. Like, everyone brings something different to the table.
I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding of what a normal STEM type person is. There is no normal. So I think, you know, there's so many areas that STEM touches and is involved in that I think we really need to redraw the boundaries to what STEM is, or STEAM. it's don't ever think you're not our normal STEM type person, because we'd be very glad to have you.
Oh, look, it's funny, actually. I remember, I think we can all think of a teacher that we had at school, in primary school, high school, college, uni, any of those things, those defining moments. And I remember my year 8 biology teacher, I asked a question and she just looked at me and went, look, I don't think you're going to get this concept. It's just not in you.
Oh, God.
And I just, oh, my Lord, I carried that around for so long. And it took me a while to put it down.
The and little words like that have enormous impact.
And it's not until you reach the grand old age of 40, 42, whatever it may be, is that you kind of go, wait a minute, why didn't I ever question that perhaps your way of teaching me was not what worked for me? It had nothing to do with me, everything to do with you. We don't think those things as a young person. They impact us massively, just those off-the-cuff comments.
Yeah, and when they come from someone, influential, like a teacher or a parent or a coach, they stick with you. Mm-hmm. So my oldest boy, who was 11, probably 3 years ago now, he got a dyslexic diagnosis, and it was one of those epiphany moments. So he was a fish being asked to climb a tree. Mm-hmm. And it's so unfair that we asked him to do that, whereas when we gave him an environment where he could learn effectively, he was unstoppable. Mm-hmm. And you're right, it came down to that change in perception. So, this approach wasn't working for him at all. So we put him on land as a fish, climb that tree over there. Oh, you're struggling. Oh, sucks to be you. And then we changed the environment. We gave him an ocean.
Yeah.
And now he's the kid who reads for fun, who reads for pleasure.
Yeah, it's amazing how... just giving the right environment can make such a difference, and stop trying to make people fit into the environment that's easy for everybody else.
Yeah, and I think our self-talk is a big part of that as well. So, I mentioned before that Matt and I are not friends, and that was an idea that I got during school, because there were ways of looking and teaching that just made no sense to me. So as an adult, I got a formal diagnosis of ADD and being on the spectrum. And so it's like watching your life, like you look back at your life like a movie and you're like, that makes more sense now. Mm-hmm. No, I wasn't bored. I wasn't dumb. I wasn't inattentive. It's just that my brain wiring wouldn't let me do that the way you wanted me to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very lucky that I found a job and a career where the strengths that I bring to the table were appreciated, were respected, were encouraged, and were not seen as negatives.
Yeah. Do you have one thing to say to somebody who potentially had that one thing said to them, or it's never one thing, but it's a cumulative, but that's the one thing you remember. What would you say to them now, or what would you say to your younger self looking back?
You don't have to be good at everything. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to be the best. I think for a very long time, I was fixated on being the best, and was constantly disappointed in myself that I wasn't the best by some subjective standard. And having said that, I think there is a beauty in doing things for the love of them that we forget, because we're so trained to be the best, to aim for perfection, that we forget the pleasure in simple things. And that it's okay not to know all of the answers. It is okay to put your hand up and say, look, I don't have enough information to have an informed opinion about that. Can I get back to you? And I think we need to learn that more, that it is okay to say, I don't know. And that is okay. And that if you are exposed to new information, you can form a new position. You know, things aren't set in stone. You can do different things. You can have different views. And now that you know better, you can do better. So I like the fact that at the top of this podcast, you asked me what my pronouns were. You didn't assume. You didn't assume, which I quite like and respect. And I think we need to do that more as a society, to be more open, to be more curious, and take that on board. You know, not everyone is the same as you, and that is a good thing.
Definitely. That's an awesome place to stop, because we're going to just carry on all afternoon. Thank you so much, Catherine.
No, thank you. This was very much the world according to Kath. No, does not represent the views of my employer. But yeah, thank you so much for the chat today. It was really wonderful to explore such a wide range of things with two amazing women. Thank you.